tell how grateful I am to be invited to America, how much reciprocal this falling in love was, and is still currently being. So thank you, all of you, for coming here and for your patience and for making hard work to understand my kind of English language. So I'm talking about my first field research, and I would like to go back about that because there are new questions that has been raised since then. But, so let's begin. That through the last 20 years, we noticed that primatologists and other scientific scholars have done substantial work to identify the reasons that could account for the changes we may notice, and we all notice, about what we see and what we know about some animals. Numerous hypotheses have been suggested. Some of them focused on human scientific activities, such as the socio-historical context of the researchers, theories, paradigms, practice, etc. While others insist that this perspective, this explanation, overlook the role of the animals themselves, they have actually changed it, and maybe we should, as Stella Worrell proposed, admit that they have also changed due to the fact that of being under constant observation. Another question has been raised by the same primatologist, newt sheepologist Thelma Roel. Why didn't most other animals, or at least not until recently, experience the same change? She claims that the way primates have been studied is radically different from the way classical ethology has been carried out for other animals. For primates, for example, long-term and individually based studies have been completed with a great deal of attention paid to the relationship and ways of communication. For other animals, short-term research has primarily approached questions about food. For example, literature about sheep, the epitome of silly animals, as she said, is all focused on what they eat and how they choose food in a pasture, or in short, as she said, how they convert grass into gigot. The question Roel raises could be asked about a number of animals. Are ravens, as we consider them today, more intelligent or socially sophisticated than other birds? How about dolphins, magpies, hyenas, and other charismatic animals that Roel would call honorary primates? If they are intelligent today, how did they get the chance to become, as Latour says, so well equipped? These very questions can be raised anytime an animal unexpectedly crosses the Rubicon, as some scientists would describe it. Simply put, what's happened to this very animal? Who gave him or her a chance and how? These are some of the questions that led me to the field station of Hatzeva in Israel's Negev Desert. It was about now 20 years ago. Yes, about 20 years ago. I wanted to see a bird, the Arabian Babbler, and to meet its Israeli ornithologist, Hamotz Zahavi. These babblers offered a sharp contrast to typical description in scientific literature of altruism in birds, the subject of the master thesis in psychology I had in that time recently received when the project formed. Babblers did not behave like birds usually do. They didn't follow what could legitimately be considered the typical bird script. In addition, the ethologist Hamotz Zahavi did not describe them as ethologists usually do. Not only were these birds described as dancing together in the morning, not only were they, according to Zahavi, eager to offer presents to one another, not only, still according to Zahavi, would they take pride in caring for each other nestling or in defending an endangered comrade, But still, according to Zahavi, the relationship relied on trust. These relationships, says Zahavi, were enacted through constant claims for one's liability and the liability of other members of the group. In short, babblers, according to Zahavi, were relentlessly testing their bonds. Back to the time when I read the literature of Zahavi, I mean the few articles Zahavi had written in that time, I had the feeling that these birds, oddly enough, were actually depicted like primatologists portrayed their primates. However, there was no doubt that they belong to species of birds. They lay eggs, at least some of them do. They have feathers, they fly, so they seem to spend much of their time on the ground. Something was wrong with the situation, and so I anticipated that it would provide a good case for some kind of critical empirical philosophy. It is worth mentioning that my question up until that time were not the same as the question I have today, as they turn out to be now. My actual purpose was, still in that time, and exactly as I mentioned in the files I completed to secure the grant for my research, to identify in that odd situation, odd birds, and an ethologist oddly accounting for them, what could account for such oddity? Was the bird really peculiar per se, or, as I confess I did suspect, could these peculiarities be ascribed to some eccentricity in geographical sense of the term also? It was really eccentric to normal academic field. So could these peculiarities be ascribed to some eccentricity of the observer? Eccentricity that, of course, I aim to disclose. Going to the field was, in other words, from that perspective, a simple and enjoyable, probably, the localization of the questions philosopher usually answer from the Cartesian cabinets. Observing the ethologist, observing his babbles, focusing on what he would say, how he would select what constitute a fact, and how he would constitute what was to be seen, would probably, I was expecting that, allow me to provide clear and critical empirical judgment. This critical empirical judgment, let us say in passing, is not, I consider today, far from the proverbial fool who, when the seven points out to the moon, looks at the seventh finger. Ultimately, I got the grant, left home, and went to the field to meet Zahavi and his babblers. And I saw them dancing. Let us say that, as Isabel Stengers told me once, the field happened to me. The Arabian babblers, let us present them, inhabits extreme desert and is the only bird species in Israel that lives in group all year round. These groups are territorial, with numbers of birds per group generally between 3 and 5 individuals, although they can range between 2 and 22. So when Zahavi describes it, it says, normally a group, in principle, a group is between 2 and 5, but most of the group don't behave that way. So in principle, means probably to be contradicted. Babblers are long-lived and may reach the age of 12 or 14, all the more since Zahavi has long worked to protect them. Babblers seem to be very peculiar birds. Not only do they help at the nest, all members of the group taking care of a single nest, but they also cooperate to protect the territory against neighboring groups of babblers and non-territorial individuals, refugees, as he calls the latter. The birds dealing with each other involve providing a great deal of assistance to others. They offer presents to feed each other, seeds, insects, flowers, before they are full themselves. They imperil themselves by coming to the rescue of group members who will get caught in a net, or by a predator, or by enemy beavers during a fight. And they play together. They also dance together in the morning, sometimes after bathing. In short, through their whole life, they cooperate. Of course, they may fight, but they fight seriously with a member of their group only once in their whole life, if ever. And if sometimes they compete with each other, and they actually do, they also compete to act as sentinel of the territory or to feed the congeners of the group, of course. What do barbers do, according to Zahavi, is questing for social status, or what become after that, social prestige. When one barber feeds another, it draws attention to itself. It emits a special trill, that way, which is very different from the call barbers usually do. Back to the time I could do that, because I could call them, because we do that when we go on the field. I will explain that to later. But the first thing that you learn when you have to absorb babblers, as they may be miles away from you, and if you don't want to run miles, and as we are not able to fly, the best thing is to make them come so you can absorb them. So we learn to imitate they call and they call. So when the babbler feeds another, it draws attention to itself, and it emits a special trill and lifts its beak above the beak of the one it is feeding. But generally, a babbler tries to avoid being fed by another bird of about the same rank in the hierarchy. It might try to escape, or in some cases, close its beak tightly, despite being hungry. And Zahavi says it will eagerly accept one of the observer crumbs of bread immediately after refusing a juicy insect from another babbler. Yes, let us say in passing that we also give some bread to the babblers when we go to the field. It helps them to come. If a lower ranking individual attempts to feed a higher ranking one, it might be beaten up. The babblers, the one who is concerned, but also all the ones who attempt the scene, especially all the more since they are called by the trill, will construe the proposals of feeding as a declaration of open revolt. First, it should be mentioned that each bird observed, nowadays among 250, is individually identified. They are all tagged with a combination of color bands on their legs. They are all, the 250, habituated, and observers may walk among them without carrying them. Observers working with a Zahavi usually give the birds tiny amounts of breadcrumbs. Most often, when going to the field and trying to find a particular group, Zahavi, as I told you, call them with a whistle and they come, which is, as explained, rather easier than trying to find them or run after them. As briefly mentioned early, Zahavi description of the bird is rather unusual in ethological discourse. He says, for example, because they are habituated to our presence, we can hear the soft, widely varied calls they use to communicate, calls that don't carry more than a few yards. Some individuals are talkative, others taciturn, and still others rumble all day long. When a higher ranking individual approaches a lower ranking one, the latter often makes a soft sound to acknowledge the other, as if, and I quote Zahavi, as if saying, "Yes, sir." The theory itself is still stranger. Babblers, as I told you, do help, do assist, do protect, do feed others in order to gain prestige. For example, Zahavi explains, a babbler who finds food may not swallow it right away, but instead may hold it in its beak and look around to see whom it can feed. If it sees only individuals whose rank is higher than its own, generally, he swallows the food. When the beta male, I quote Zahavi, the number two of a group, the number two of a, yes, the number two male of a group, goes up to the top of a tree to stand up as a sentinel, we often see the alpha male is superior, busily looking for food. He then gives it to the sentinel in full view of the other members of the group and replaces on guard duty. In many cases, we can tell when the sentinel notices the alpha male's preparation to feed him from the direction of the sentinel's gaze, and often because the sentinel abandons his lofty post before the alpha males arrives to displace him. In the field, I also met John, an ethologist we had studied in Oxford. John was young, but he was already an experienced ethologist. He was also, and still is, a sociobiologist. He was there when I was visiting, and he was also working with Babblers. John definitively does not agree with the Harvey's theory. According to John, if Babblers help, it is because they want to maximize the inclusive fitness. In helping close kin, each individual may expect to pass on part of his genetic pool. Following and listening to either John or the Harvey gave me the feeling that we were not dealing with the same birds. The first difference between John and the Harvey was obvious. They totally disagreed about what could be said, or more precisely, what could count as true hypothesis. For the Harvey, a hypothesis about Babblers is true in some way because Babblers provide clear evidence of it. Or to put it another way, humans may assume a particular hypothesis about Babblers because Babblers never act without good reasons. For John, by contrast, a hypothesis is true only if you can prove it, and to prove it is to experiment. In other words, the Harvey trusts what the Babblers show, or what the Babblers says in showing. John trusts the experiment that will make the Babblers concede to behave in such a way that it confirms an hypothesis. The Harvey follows, moves inside the group, listens to the Babblers, pay attention to what the Babbler look at, and may therefore become aware of the intentions. He pays attention to each tiny differences of vocalization. Why does a Babbler shoot so loud when it treats on another one? Of course we shoot when we are angry. But in the case of the Babblers, the shooting is not aimed at the purported listener, but rather at other Babblers that are farther away. The shooting make them witnesses. Let us notice passing that Thelma Roll proposed a similar hypothesis to account of fighting in sheep. I think she says that one of the functions of the fighting is coordination. Or, more precisely, the result of fighting is coordination. The female, she notes, takes a keen interest in the fight, to the fight. When you are doing this, it makes a lovely loud noise. And if somebody is fighting here, the youth will come running to watch. And so I said, all right, let us say that it's not a fight. This is a display. How could a sheep make a loud noise by himself? It is a sound one hand clapping. You can do that. But with two of them, you make a spectral noise and a visual display. And so she does that like sheep do. And it's very exciting to the youth, and they all coming and eat together, and that's it's all over. Why do Babblers sometimes spread their wings upward when approaching a snake, making themselves more visible? They must have good reason to act in such a dangerous way. Babblers is a Harvey, want to show off the courage to other members of the group. And that is why they call the attention to themselves in that situation. What Babblers show is nothing less than what they mean to show. I would suggest that the Harvey may be very confident because his theory claims that signals are always reliable or honest. What you see is what it's worth. Could define the way Beblos behave according to Zahavi, since signals are of prestige are very costly. Like we say, you know, doing that in front of a snake might be more costly than doing that. Feeding others or acting as a sentinel involves times and resources. If a Beblos cannot afford it, it will be prevented from doing it. This theory is called by Zahavi the handicap principle theory. To make it clearer, we may take, for example, the relationship between prey and predators. Paradoxically, at first glance, you may find the rule of honesty in the encounter between a gazelle and a lion when the gazelle reveals itself to the predator that might not spot it. Why ask the Zahavi, a gazelle, waste time and energy? Okay, did you see that the gazelle jumping very high and generally is considered that it's an act of altruism because it's doing that when the gazelle sees the lion, it calls to the attention of the other gazelle. So it acts altruistically and takes a risk because the lions would, of course, spot it. And so it has been considered as altruistic and risky. However, Zahavi doesn't think so. He says it's not a matter of sacrifice, and he noticed that if you see one of these gazelles be eaten by a lion, it never happens, as a matter of fact. Of course, what Zahavi says that this gazelle doing that is signaling to the predator that it has been seen. By wasting time and by jumping high in the air, rather than bounding away, the gazelle demonstrates in a reliable way that she or he is, David say it, it is able to outrun the lion. The lion, upon learning that it has lost its chance to surprise its prey, and that this gazelle is in tip-top physical shape, may decide to look for more promising prey. In the same vein, by showing off how much they can invest in standing guard, in feeding others, in taking serious risk, Beblos show off the ability to win in a fight and the desirability as group mates. From John's points of view now, one cannot simply claim whatever they want, feel, think, expect when explaining the bird's behavior, unless the person can design an experiment to demonstrate this hypothesis. For example, in order to prove that the behaviors of helping in the nest and feeding chicks are not governed, as Zahavi thinks, by motives of prestige, John thinks that he needs to show that these behaviors are determined by other rules, in that precise case by sociobiological rules of kinship selection. John aims to show that helpers and parents' provision for nestling at similar rates, irrespective of sex or dominance rank within the group. If, for example, the nestling were very hungry, parents would enhance the effort. On the other hand, helpers at the nest, if this were solely a matter of prestige, wouldn't be sensitive to the change of condition. If the chick are more hungry, it doesn't matter if it's only a question of prestige. So John decided to put this hypothesis to the test. Some playback of tapes showing chick begging, enhancing the feeding from both the parents and the helpers at the nest, show, according to him, evidence that the helpers have the same provisioning rule as the parents and therefore do not use nestling feeding as an altruistic signal to gain social prestige. When I asked Zahavi about experimentation, he told me, of course we do experiments with Beblos. We ask them to come, we tell them what we want them to do, and the question we are dealing with, and they do it. I will never be sure Zahavi wasn't serious. Zahavi offers the Beblos something that is not far from the process of domestication. a process which transforms the involvement in the relationship. They, him and the barbers do something and they do it together. The experiment is not any longer about the barbers or focused upon the barbers. The experiment is led with them. The experiment, in other words, domesticates both the harvest practices and the barber's usage. They are becoming with. And this becoming with both rests upon and produces beings that are differently articulated and that articulate differently. Becoming with is a very practical and concrete process. The Avi aims to think like a barber thinking like a human, we might say. Who thinks like whom, actually? Thinking with does not close the question, it opens it and it keeps it open. By contrast, considering the way John questioned the barbers, we could assume that he wouldn't have thought of the birds as acting like humans or being led by anthropomorphic motives. However, things are sometimes more complicated than what we should expect. At one point, John and I were observing a group of barbers feeding at the nest, and we were close, but not that close to the nest. We were just a few feet away from the little trees, the acacia. And at one particular moment, I noticed that one of the birds made the trail, signaling that he was feeding. And I was almost sure that this babbler didn't offer the food. So I asked John, did I see it? Well, I didn't see the babblers giving. He told me, of course you're right, he didn't give. Therefore, I wonder why the bird had falsely vocalized the signal. If I could see that the babbler was deceiving, surely the other babblers could see this too. John answered to me, oh, it's very easy to understand. This bird is carrying out a real experiment, he says. He just wants to assess the real state of hunger of the chicks, so he just modifies one of the variables. I was intrigued. Clearly, John was assigning his own scientist ethos to the babblers. Of course, this story demonstrates that what scientists call anthropomorphism is always someone anthropomorphism, common sense anthropomorphism, or more precisely, the layperson anthropomorphism. In other words, what I want to mean, if the birds are acting and thinking as scientists would think and act, which they were doing, this is not anthropomorphism, it is natural rule. This is naturomorphism, and naturomorphism is not a sin. But it also shows us the real contrast between two ways of thinking. John and Zahavi inhabit the two extremes of the continuum between being scientist in the one side and being naturalist. And being naturalist on the one side, which are two very different ways of construing behavior of the birds. More generally, it was clear that Zahavi's way of observing and thinking were very close to the naturalist style, whereas John was working within the classical ethnological tradition. Zahavi talks about his babbler as anthropologists talk about the human subject. They have agency, intentions, hopes, desires, and he may adopt their perspective. John's descriptions are highly abstract and technical. For example, I just quote one article of John. Arabian barbers provide an interesting focus for discussion. This is highly abstract. They're already interesting focus for discussion that they being. That's what defined them. An interesting focus for discussion regarding unselected helping, because this system involves apparent cost and benefits of helping that are very similar in scale to those of parental provisioning. Don't try to understand. I didn't at first, like, and there's another way. The point was to make it, to show that it was not understandable for lay people. And I'm a lay people in that case. Moreover, John Bubblers are determined by simple and rigid rules. According to kink selection theory, the variation in chick feeding effort by helpers reflect the evolutionary interest in provisioning the young. Helpers increase the effort, I quote John again, in accordance with the net fitness returns from investment in the brood. Hence, more related chicks should be fed at higher rates and helping should be adjusted according to both its energetic cost, I put the sigma, and current brood demand for food. This is the way sociobiology general treat animals and talks about them. The animals in that frame, anyway, what interests me, that the animals in the frame become completely interchangeable. They are models for the whole species. Species-specific pattern, would say Lorenz. Zahavi, by contrast, is more interested in individual differences than in models. And he assumes that he ought to be interested in individual differences because that is of the utmost importance for the Bubblers themselves. The endlessly, I cannot say this word, you understand it, seek and show off differences between themselves. And this leads John and Zahavi to observe very different things. John is seeking for a modern and is therefore paying attention to the behavior that can either be integrated into or that will fulfill or confirm the modern. He actively selects. Far be it from me to suggest that Zahavi is not selective. Of course he does select, but he selects different events. John is selecting variation in patterns. Zahavi is selecting varieties. John's approach is close to the experimental way of constructing data. Zahavi looks for varieties in anecdotes, little stories, individual bird biographies. He fills the life with motive, intention, singular aims. John asks the Bubblers to be experimental objects. The experimental device mirrors the work of nature that controls events and beings. Birds are being, in John's device, are being controlled and constrained by the same external rules. In focusing on different events, John and Zahavi construct different narratives in which still more different events matter and may be observed. John, for example, concedes that he might not have paid attention to some subtle events while he was observing, and that the fact of not taking this event into account might have, but really, actually, has not favored one hypothesis. Bubblers have the nest in kin oriented. Over another, Bubblers compete for prestige and for feeding nest. However, I would suggest that the problem is not merely a lack of attention to events and details. It is a practical problem. The manner in which each approaches the Bubblers is not the same. The question of control, place and relationship are crucial. The distance between the observer and the observed, both concrete and subjective, the involvement of their presence and their bodies, the way they address the birth and the manners in which they present themselves are different. All these differences certainly modify the attention paid to the babbler's behavior and their own selective attention. In suggesting the possibility that observer selective attention might be bonded to the practice itself, as well as to be embodied presence of the observer in the field, I raise a question that was studied by another scientist observing the blabablos at the site, Roni Ortsayer. Roni was there because he was working with Zahavi for years. He investigates whether or not the close presence of the observer may influence the way the bablos behave. He relates, for example, that once a dominant bird felt forced to act as a sentinel because of the observer's presence, and he therefore could not feed the chicks. In order to assess this possibility, John, as a good experimenter, compared observation at different distances and found no differences. But I think that John is wrong. The question of the observer's influence, if we put it that way, as an experimental question, make another difference, which is very more, I think that is more important, and it makes this difference less visible. Because the difference is not only between observers, it rests between the way observers take into account the differences between groups and how they question which enhance or decrease this difference between groups. For John, all groups behave in approximately the same way with regard to his hypothesis. This means that the hypothesis may easily discard as innocuous parasite the difference between groups, and that this difference will not be perceived. For Zahavi, by contrast, each group is unique. Of course, each group faces the same problem and they find similar solutions, but each group has its own style of facing the problem or of achieving this solution. For example, Zahavi explained that the relationship between the first and the second males, first and second denoting the place in the hierarchy, is not the same in all groups. It depends a great deal on the makeup of the particular group. Even when the two males are brothers, this relationship may varies from group to group. For example, the prestige of one vis-à-vis another may be radically different from one group to another, which dramatically changes the way they behave. Since prestige means for babblers the respect accorded to an individual by others, it also changes the behavior of the whole group. Groups have their own style, depending partly on the respect accorded, and babblers have, according to Zahavi, their own personalities or temperaments. We also find evidences, however, that Zahavi adopt the perspectives of the animal he observes, and moreover, embodies this perspective. Reading some excerpts of his work, one can see this very embodiment in his methodology, acting as a kind of bodily identification. It includes, like I mentioned before, following the gaze of the sentinel, for example, and knowing exactly what it should do next, as well as what the observer should look at next. This embodiment entails thinking with the bird, looking with it rather than looking at it, and knowing its intentions. Bablos and humans share common traits in that narrative, built by the work and the narratives of the ethology. These traits include body posture, shifting of glances, common anticipation, what happened next, and last but not least, common stories. These common stories are not just narrative that would create or rest upon mere hermeneutical analogies. These common stories are enacted in, as well as produced by, a common story and a common history. Both humans and babblers create narratives rather than just telling them. They create, disclose new scripts. Each story with Zahavi is a scene full of actors, inhabiting an existential world, living adventures that give them a history, a bibliography, a personality, and a full repertoire of will, intention, and agency. For example, Zahavi is telling a story that in one case he says an 8-month-old female tried to feed a 10-month-old sister. As a matter of fact, she could not, normally. And he told, the latter stood up, snatched the food out of her younger sister beak, forced her to crouch like one begging for food, and then stuffed the food down her throat. And he says, Babler's behavior, the conclusion is, it's pretty conclusion. Babler behaved as though it was the act of giving rather than the benefit given that matters. This conclusion is worthy of attention. For Zahavi, the right question to ask is animal, the question which produces interest is what matters to the babblers. A final babbler eccentricity will clearly illustrate that. As I mentioned in the beginning of this chapter, babblers dance. So you can go to YouTube and you just type. But you have to morning dance babblers. You have to put morning, otherwise you will have one of them. If you hear the music, it helps to see them dancing because it's a pop, 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 pop. But don't worry, if you turn off the music, it's so good. So you will see the dancing of the babblers. And so they make lines and they begin to print them each other and print themselves, you know, and move that way. I won't do that. I won't do that. And after that, you see one to jump. To be in the middle of the line and does that, you know. And sometimes they make sound because it's really pretty and funny and cute. I told you, when I went to the field, my feeling was, of course, babblers don't dance. That's just, you know, kind of extravagant theories. And when I saw babblers dancing, this was not an extravagant theory. It was babblers dancing, and I had to take that into account. That's the worst story. So, the morning dance. It happens once every several days, and it takes place almost exclusively at the first light of the day. So, Zahavi tried to understand why babblers dance, and it was a big controversy, but I will explain just what Zahavi thinks about. Zahavi says that we have to pay attention to two facts. The first one, babblers dance in the open, near a bush, even though they could dance more safely under trees. And secondly, they do it before sunrise. This is exactly the most dangerous place and the most dangerous time of the day. The danger from raptors is greatest, since they can explore the low light and surprise the babblers with relative ease. This is also the best time for babblers to feed normally, since many night creatures are still active, termites, insects, and so on and so on. So according to Zahavi, this choice of place and time explains why babblers dance. They do it at the most inconvenient times and place because to undertake this is the most reliable way of showing the reliable commitment to the group. Dancing is a way to test the quality of the relationship and to assess it. The importance of partnership to its members and the relationship between partners depend on many factors that can easily change, which makes frequent testing of the social bond essential. The testing not only assesses the bond and its reliability, it creates it. Rituals perform social links. The dance of the babbler leads us to a last hypothesis, one raised by Ronnie when he noticed that babbler tended to dance the day after he recorded a group with his rather heavy camera in a very close distance. As a matter of fact, when Ronnie was on the field, babblers could know that because he was, you know, just tapping in the trees, you know, the babblers to take. So, this fact led me to ask the question, do babblers react to the presence of the observer or do they respond to the presence of the observer? And this reminds us the reader telling about being seen by his cats and asked to be responsible of that gaze. If I put it in another way, my question will become more concrete. Which kind of practice and more general theories or ethologies could make this shift possible between animal react to the presence of the observer or they respond to the presence of the observer? Theories, which would mean that theories do not only affect what scientists think they should see, and they, therefore what they actually see. Theories affect what they do, who they are, and therefore the way animals see the scientists seeing them, the way animals respond to the scientists. So which kind of theories or practice could afford to take that into account? So we found a lot of practice in primatology. You know, primatologists know that the animals respond to them. Thelma Howell also tells really, really interesting stories about habituation, saying that when primatologists believe that they habituate the animals, that the work is done by them, like the primatologists, she said maybe it's not that clear, that because normally most of monkeys she observed notice very quickly that when the observer was on the field, predator didn't come anymore. And so they understand it very quickly, so they prefer to have their own observer. As soon as they understand that the observer is less dangerous than the predator, you know. So habituation might be partly done by the animals themselves, and I like this hypothesis. So back to Zahavi, I would like to consider the peculiarity of Zahavi's practice. First, I've already suggested Zahavi is undertaking with his butler a hermeneutic approach grounded on common rationality, a kind if I were him or her way of thinking. This, of course, might be also suspected of heavy anthropomorphism. Instead of putting himself in the babbler's shoes, Zahavi would actually be asking the birds to wear human shoes. The perspective would not be in that case the babbler's one, but would only reflect a human situated standpoint. However, we can identify another characteristic of the practice, a characteristic I mentioned previously in passing. When arriving in a group territory that may be relatively wide, Zahavi calls the babblers. He invites them and offers them presents, typically some piece of bread that is generally accepted eagerly by the birds. I could suggest that each encounter in the field actually look like a request. Come, babblers, and show me what you can do. It seemed as though the babblers were being actively requested to cooperate with the scientists. When Zahavi says that babblers help the experimenter, isn't he himself suggesting this hypothesis? But I would also suggest that because babblers are so fond of exhibition, and because scientists, thanks to Zahavi's signal theory, are looking for babblers to exhibit, in some sense we could think that babblers are requested to do what they do well and what they feel at ease in doing, showing off, exhibiting. Babblers, then, might be more sensitive to being seen and to seeing with seeing them, since scientists are responsive to what they do. That is why the birds come so easily when Zahavi calls them. It is as if Zahavi was saying to them, come babblers and show me. Of course, they are crumbs of bread. This is exactly what a behaviorist would say. It's conditioning or something like that, you know, that's a reward. Behaviorists, however, made us forget that to give is a relationship per se, and I think that sadly, they succeeded in making starving animals the norm, as if animals were only interested in food, stomach is full, you know. Might the babblers be construing Zahavi offer as a greeting? Do they greet the scientist? I don't have the answer to this question, but I strongly affirm that Zahavi is clearly greeting his babblers, and he does that with a present, bread, with his body. When, you know, if you have to see babblers, I mean, if you go to see babblers on YouTube and on photo, you will see that Zahavi, first thing he does when he sees the babblers, he puts himself, and after that he sits and the babblers come on his shoulders and so on. So, when he sits among, what John wouldn't do, of course, when he sits among the babblers, when they approach closer and closer, when they come on his arms, when he turns his hand, he does greeting them with his gaze, with his voice. And babblers do understand that the question of prestige is not at stake between them. if one remembers that they accept food from the scientist after after having resisted a congenial offer. But the hypothesis that Bablos might be more sensitive to being seen and to seeing with seeing them, since Zahavi is responsive to what they do, particularly delights me. This hypothesis answers in an unpredictable way to the very question I first had when I came to the field, the very question I promptly had to abandon. But the hypothesis gives a new meaning to the answer, a new constructivist and non-relativist translation to that famous and rather tired assertion, the very one I actually shared a long time ago when I was completing the files to get a grant. The behavior of the animals is the product of the observer's vision. The new translation that I propose slightly changes some of the words of this assertion. I would suggest that the way animals act are the consequences of the observer's gaze. Yes, indeed, the actions are the responsible consequences, responsible consequences. Let us not forget the consequences is consequent following closely of a non-less responsible gift. Thank you for your patience.